Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRT-LP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. You can find us online anytime at kdrt.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. I'm your host. Thank you for tuning in. Well, if you're feeling stressed, maybe I should say when you're feeling stressed, ember lighting could help you feel better. So concludes some research at the University of California, Davis, that UC Davis writer Greg Watry described this past summer in his article, The Color Lab Uncovers the Soothing Effects of Lights. This discovery touches on psychology as well as lighting and design. And today on Davisville, we'll talk with two of the people involved in this research, Srinivasan Meyyappan, and he's an assistant project scientist in the Center for Mind and Brain, who ran the relevant experiment at the Color Lab. And psychology and neurology distinguished professor Ron Mangan. He's the co-director of the center. I need to define a couple of those names. I just threw a lot of institutional names at you there. The Color Lab is a research collaboration between the California Lighting Technology Center and the Center for Mind and Brain. The Color Lab seeks to use lighting designs to optimize well-being among people. All of this research occurs at UC Davis and is illustrative of the interdisciplinary thread that you'll see a lot at UC Davis. Anyway, Srinivasan or Srini, as people call you, and Ron, thank you for taking time to talk with us today on Davisville. Can I get you to start by each just saying your name to help people keep track what your voices sound like?
This is Ron Mangan. Hi.
This is Srinivasan Meyyappan. Srini, hi.
Well, let's get started. So as I thought about this, lighting seems easy to take for granted, right? It's just there. It's like air, water, land under our feet. It just lights our way. But it does a lot more than that, doesn't it? It influences our behavior and how we feel, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think all of us know that when the time change occurs twice a year, there's a big effect. Has an influence on our health, our safety, and our happiness. And that's one thing that's obvious to everybody, but there are more subtle influences of lighting, and that's one of the things that I guess you want to talk to us about today.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me come right to the core of it, and then I'm going to want to understand a little later about how you figured this out. But the gist of it is that amber lighting reduces stress. Why is that? How does it work that way?
So one of the things about amber lighting is that it is very close to sunsets and it has a lot of ecological validity. I mean, it helps us wind down at the end of the day. And so sunsets kind of have this calming effect on our body. And that's the similar lighting that we used in the experiment we had in the study.
So it resembles sunset. Is it that simple?
Well, that's one way we can try to conceptualize it. I mean, I think that if we want to get to a deeper biological mechanism for it, we don't have that answer exactly. We know the effect, and we know it has an effect on our biology. And this is one way that we can kind of conceptualize why that might be.
Well, I mean, it rings true. I know nothing of this kind of research myself, but sunset's the end of the day. It's kind of soothing. You draw in at the end of the day. And I guess that's the effect that you're seeing here. You tried other colors as well. Well, you tested rather red, green, blue, and white. And if I understood correctly, the red, green, and blue didn't calm the subjects any more than white. It did, right? But amber was the one that did, but not the others.
Yes, that's right. So the white lighting was what we call as a control condition, which is the reason we called it as a control condition is because that's the light we typically see in our indoor lighting. And we first exposed our participants to that lighting. So participants, when they came into our color lab, saw the white lighting. And in the experiment, we compared these lighting conditions with the white light. And our results suggest that the amber lighting resulted in a more calming effect compared to white light, which was not found in the other lighting conditions, which is the blue, red, and green.
Is it much of a difference?
So we did this study with about 100 participants as a whole, and each lighting had like 20 participants in each group. So the effects that we observed were significant. Also, in terms of how significant it was, so it was when compared to the white light, we had about 70% more calming effect for the amber lighting So that was a pretty significant effort.
How do you measure if someone is calmer? Part of that's subjective, right? Well, I mean, I imagine there's physical reactions you can measure. And I know there's a wonderful video that goes with Greg's article that illustrates the experiment. People can actually watch that and see how you did it. But it seems the measurement would be a little elusive in terms of, you know, if someone is feeling 9 on a scale of 10 for stress, how do you know this is taking them to a 6 or a 5 or a 4 or whatever?
Well, that's a great question. Let me begin by putting it in context. Srini and I are cognitive neuroscientists. In fact, Srini is a biomedical engineer by training. I'm a neuroscientist by training. We were part of a team that included lighting experts, and that's Michael Simonovich and Jae Young Suk, who are professors at UC Davis, and they're the past and current director of the California Lighting Technology Center. And the third partner, fifth partner is Professor Cam Hostinar, who's in our Center for Mind and Brain. And she's an expert on studies of stress. So I want to put that all together to kind of frame what the interdisciplinary team was like. And we used expertise from all sides to kind of come to this experimental design. Okay, now back to your question. We used a couple of different standard methods, and Srini can go into this a little bit for us, to index stress. And these are standard methods that have been well validated over many decades. One is looking at cortisol, a hormone that's related to stress. Another is looking at brain electrical activity that indexes stress. And maybe Srini can tell a little bit about how we did that, especially the electrical recordings, which is something that our laboratory are experts in.
Srini, yeah, tell us about it.
So just what Rana described. So we used two approaches. One is the cortisol. The other one was recording the electrical activity, which is known as electroencephalography, which is also short form for EEG, which is basically recording brain potentials completely non-invasively, just placing some sensors on the scalp. And we record the activity when you're just doing a specific task or anything. That's our expertise. So in this experiment, we invited participants to the color lab and had them fill out some forms and everything. During that time, we had the white light. Then we wanted to induce stress to participants in a very controlled and a standardized manner. And the task that we used is known as a Trier social stress test, which is a technical term for asking participants to give a speech. So it's a public speech, and we all know that when we are giving a public speech, most of us are likely to be stressed, and our stress responses go up. And we track that using when participants were giving the speech. Also, we were recording their brain potentials, so we know they were stressed, but we were also getting the measure or a quantifiable metric of what the stress response is from the brain potentials. After they were stressed, we brought them to the color lab and we exposed them to one of the lighting conditions, which was either the amber or red or green or blue or the control condition, which is white, because it's called control because we had the same lighting throughout the experiment. And so we know how we can measure stress responses, which is known as comparing the activity in the frontal cortex, which we call as the frontal alpha symmetry, the technical term. And we measured how calming they are using these metrics.
Okay. Yeah, the test is described also in the article and in the video. And well, for example, the one, and I got to say, I feel some sympathy for the subject here. She's standing in front of the camera facing a panel of people wearing masks. They're in the dark. She's got the light shining on her. And she's supposed to start counting back by 13 from what, 1,002, I think it was. And then she talks. And when she's done, the group tells her, "You're not done talking. Keep talking." But what I took from that seriously was that these were efforts to replicate everyday stress. In other words, this isn't necessarily huge trauma that you were testing, but more like a lot of us might feel just going through the day.
That's fair enough. In fact, in some studies of stress, people do use different forms of stress. One really common one that sounds unpleasant because it is asking people to plunge their hand into a bucket of ice water. Well, we did want to do that. So I think your point is well made.
You know, now hearing that amber lighting reduces stress, I got to wondering, are there lighting colors? This isn't part of your research, I don't think, but I don't tell me. Are there lighting colors that work the opposite way? That is, that they serve to agitate instead of soothe.
Well, that's a very good question. We didn't study that. One can assume that that would be true. And our data just doesn't speak to it really. We can assume by looking at our data though that that a room that's lit in red really isn't very calming, and probably your intuition tells you that that's true. Whether we could devise yet other colors that would be really disruptive and upsetting, I'm sure that our friends in the color lab at the California Lighting Technology Center might have some ideas about that. So next time we have to bring them on board for the interviews.
Another question I had about this is I wondered, is the effect, does the calming effect require a person to have vision? In other words, if a person's vision is impaired, if they're blind, does the calming effect still affect them?
In the experiment, or at least we can speak for the data, we selected participants who had at least corrected vision. So at least they were either wearing glasses or not wearing glasses. So that was one of the criteria we used. And yeah, I mean, we would assume that there are visual properties of these lighting which can induce this calming effect. That would be our assumption.
Ron, you said this in Greg's article, which I thought was interesting, and it speaks maybe to this broader impact of lighting. You said, lighting affects so many aspects of our psychology and our biology, and we don't know all the details about how that works. And even what we do know hasn't really been translated that well into everyday use. So I imagine this is part of the research that you folks are doing here, but I wondered if you could expand on that a little bit. I mean, is lighting by and large unknown territory about how it affects us?
Well, let me say that we have a lot of information about lighting and how it affects us, and we have open questions about the exact mechanisms. And we also have this mismatch between the science and what it tells us, and then how people behave in everyday situations. So, for example, let me just give you a concrete example. And by the way, this is all well within the expertise of our colleagues over in the California Lighting Technology Center. This is the kind of thing that they think about. They're a world-class center aimed at understanding these kinds of properties of light and how they affect everyday behaviors and how they can best be optimized. And they're also an active group in policy in terms of lighting. For example, what kind of lighting should we use in our streetlights to maximize our ability to see at night while minimizing light pollution? These are the kinds of things that they think about. And this partly addresses your question, but let me give you an example. We know a lot about lighting and which lighting is more conducive for being able to work and work in different situations. In our center, recently, in one of the laboratories, they needed to have some bulbs replaced in the lighting. So the landlord of our facility came and replaced all the bulbs with a new LED bulb, which uses less energy. So I went to visit that laboratory to find out that everybody in the lab is kind of depressed about it because they used a different color temperature that wasn't as warm as the lighting that had been in there before, and now the room seemed a little bit gray, and they really disliked it. They didn't like to be in the lab, and these are people who like to be in the lab working, and they didn't like to be in the lab. So suddenly, their work is being influenced by the lighting. And you ask, well, how could this happen? I mean, we must know that this is true. Well, yeah, we do know it's true. But that wasn't being taken into consideration at that moment. Instead, the folks that were changing the bulbs out picked bulbs that were lower energy and stuck them right in there. And we do this all the time to ourselves. We fail to optimize the lighting in ways that we already know we should. Maybe another example is when I was in graduate school, we had a one room where the graduate students could have their desks. And the lighting in there was so dim that halfway through the year, I started to get headaches around my eyes, the tension headaches. And it took me a long time to figure out that it was because it was so dim in there, and I was doing a lot of reading at that point, that I was straining my eyes. And all I had to do was bring in another light and stick it on my desk. I brought a personal light and stuck it on my desk, turned it on so it was bright, everything cleared up. So you see this we know a lot, even simple things, and sometimes fail to act on them. But more to the point, there might be cases, situations in lighting that really have a major impact on how people can perform their jobs. take the situation, if you've had the unfortunate situation of being in a hospital room for a period of time, you know that especially in the evenings, you want to turn the lights off, turn them down so people can work. But then you have the nurses and the medical staff and others that are coming and going, having to go in and out of bright light into dark light into bright light and so on. And they're also shift workers where they're changing the time of day that they come and go. And so this is affecting their biology, and it's well known that that's a strain on people. So Michael Seminovich and his colleagues have addressed this, including here at UC Davis, trying to advise on what would be the best lighting environments to minimize that biological and psychological stress on the staff so that they could best perform their tasks. And this is a very, very important thing. We want our medical professionals to be happy and healthy and able to function. So we know a lot, but we often don't act on what we know.
Do a quick station ID. This program is Davisville on KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California, kdrt.org/Davisville. And we are talking with Professor Ron Mangan and Srinivasan Meyyappan, or Srini for short, about some research about amber lighting and how that helps calm people, but then also lighting research in general. Srini, you said something in Greg Watry's article that I thought was interesting that I wanted to highlight as well. And you said a unique aspect of this lighting intervention is that it's very passive. Other interventions like yoga or meditation are more experiential and involve a lot of effort from the user, but lighting interventions can be passively administered and doesn't involve much effort after being set up. And this intervention can easily supplement other wellness interventions. Now, of course, you were talking about the calming effect of lighting there. Although, Ron, this is reminding me of what you just said here a minute ago, that if you set up the right environment, you can help people feel better, succeed, do better, and it doesn't require a lot of extra effort once you've done it. But Srini, anything you want to add to that statement? Because I thought that was interesting. What you're basically saying is this is very practical. If we can just set things up this way, people will feel better and they won't have to worry about it.
Yeah, when we started this project, that was one thing that came to our mind, that we wanted something that is calming and does not involve a lot of effort. That is because this project was partly funded by an industry partner, Toyota Bushoku America, and they wanted to have a lighting intervention when people are in automobiles. So when you're in an automobile, you're probably involved in other activities. So you want something that does not require additional effort from the user standpoint. So this lighting effect is very passive. Once you set it up, you don't have to think about it or you don't have to worry about it, but you can still derive the positive effects of this in terms of calming. And the additional thing about this is for stress mitigation, there are other approaches, like there are pharmacological interventions, there are non-pharmacological interventions like yoga, meditation, and other forms. And this one can be easily coupled or added to any of those metrics. And so you can get the good benefits of both of them. So that's our goal.
Do you have any sense from your research so far how much the intensity of the light matters? Does a dim amber light, is that as effective as a more intense?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that is some of the things that we are following up right now. So we're trying to change the intensities and also trying to change a few other parameters and then investigate the effects of these lighting and how generalizable they are.
One thing that I take away from all this research is it is very, very practical. And Ron, I took your point earlier too, that this is the idea of working across disciplines. Someone discovers something over here in lab A, and rather than being isolated over there, others learn about it and they apply it. And, Ron, in your case, a better light bulb probably made you a better graduate student, probably. It amplified your skills, so to speak.
It did help, yes.
How do individuals vary in their responses? Do you have a sense of that? I mean, if someone is very agitated, are they calmed more than someone who's only mildly agitated? I might be asking questions I realize have gotten beyond your research, but I just find this a fascinating subject.
Well, we think that's actually a really important question. It's something that we thought about. Maybe Srini can jump in here, but people do vary. People vary in their reaction to stresses. They vary in their background stress, levels of anxiety, and so on. They also vary in their stress across the the course of the day, which is one thing that we controlled for by trying to run the studies always at certain times of day. So we didn't have that as a confounding variable. And the way that we designed the study, the changes that we were looking at would be riding on top of any other background changes in the individuals. So people coming in with high stress, people coming in with low stress, or being highly stressed or somewhat less stressed by the task, we assume that that's happening. And that our design takes that into considerations by using a population design, for example, and by the way that our baselines are baselined against each individual's sort of baseline state. So what would be interesting, though, is to know, is our manipulation more or less effective in people as a function of these factors? That we can't really tell you based on our design. And you're right, we didn't design the experiment to do that. It's possible to investigate that. Srini, do you want to add anything to that?
I think you covered, summed it up pretty well.
Another question I guess I had along those lines was if the effect, if it still works, if someone is aware of the manipulation. You know, if I'm going to a dentist's office and I'm stressed about an appointment and I go in there and I've heard this interview, and so I see Amber Light and I think, oh, they've got Amber Light. They're trying to calm me down. Now, I would like to think I'd welcome that and go, hey, I appreciate that. I'm going to feel better now as I go in and get my root canal or whatever. But I'm wondering if someone is aware of what's going on, does that affect the effect?
Yeah, I think we can say it does because that's the classic sort of placebo effect. If I just tell you that I'm using lighting, that'll calm me down, it'll probably calm you down. I was thinking you were going to say the opposite is after hearing this story, you go to the dentist and your dosh darn dentist is using white light and you're thinking, why isn't he using amber? And now you're agitated at your dentist and that doesn't help when he's drilling on your teeth.
Now,
You know,
you raise a good point there, though. I mean, I guess once something becomes a standard, then people would say, hey, get with it. Put Amber Light in there.
Yeah, I think so. And one of the, you raised medical procedures. That's actually one of the cases that Michael Seminovich and his colleagues raised with us in kind of motivating this study as well is that these are highly stressful environments. Going to the dentist is a good choice of a highly stressful environment. Another one is being put into, say, a scanner, a brain or a body scanner. Because of the close, if you're claustrophobic a little bit, everybody's a little bit. You have to go inside of a tight space, and then this machine is making a bunch of racket and doing things you don't understand. It's a stressful environment having a test like that. And the lighting that's being used in those situations, might be a factor that you could use to control and to help people manage their stress in those settings. But only if you think about it.
Human nature being what it is, I'm sure some people will hear research like this and try to think how they can use it to manipulate people in ways that may not be beneficial. Do you think about that at all?
Well, you raised the question earlier, and that made me think about it. You asked, what about lights that would agitate people? That's certainly something that could be of concern in certain situations. But I think if someone wants to manipulate a crowd by having amber light so that they can have a more conducive discussion with them, that might be a good thing. I think that certainly the psychology of group interactions and politics and those kinds of things. Those folks kind of do know that what you have in the environment affects how people react, whether it's just the imagery, but maybe also the lighting,
Yeah.
something that gets a crowd, kind of energized, might be good in some circumstances and really kind of productive in others. Do I worry about that? I think that we want to understand the basic science here. And sure, we worry that someone might misuse something. But I think in this particular set of studies we're doing, we don't see maybe a great, I think the benefits of being aware and using it in a positive way are going to much outweigh the potential negative by someone using it in a nefarious way. At least that's what we hope.
Yeah, I mean, as I thought about the question, I thought, well, weaponizing amber light doesn't sound like a very effective weapon. Maybe it's a lack of imagination on my part, but I also know human nature can be ingenious in turning things. We have just a couple of minutes left. I wanted to ask about research funding. The Trump administration has cut a lot of research funding. I'm just wondering how you guys are all doing. Are you able to sort of get the money you need to continue this work?
Yeah, thanks for that question. That's a very important one. We believe in science and we believe that the knowledge that we get from science benefits all of society, and that can be demonstrated in many different ways. So the investment in science, scientific research pays itself back many times over in how it influences our economy, our health, our safety, and everything else. It is a tough time right now, and I think that what we're seeing is a national discussion led by political changes in Washington about what the value of science is and how we should fund it. It does create some anxiety for us going forward. We're continuing our research scientists are continuously writing grants and renewing their funding to keep the operation going. It's actually an entrepreneurial-like activity. People usually don't think of it that way, but it is. Individual investigators or groups of investigators have to secure funds, and anything that reduces the amount of funds makes it very difficult and challenging. A lot of our funding comes from the federal government, the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, and then, of course, we already mentioned some of our private partners like Toyota and the Kavli Foundation, which supports some of our work. In fact, some of the work related to what we're talking about today. If there's a reduction in funding, it just makes it harder and harder to get funded. It's already the case that nationally, many more grants are receive evaluations that go through a peer review process, receive evaluations that suggest that the work would be really beneficial and we should pay for it, but there's already not there, historically, there wasn't already enough money. And so maybe 10 to 15% of grants are funded after a very rigorous selection process. If that drops to 8 to 12% or 7 to 10%, it's going to have an impact not only on the research community, but on training, and then the impact of science and what it can contribute to society.
Okay.
And society, has to think about that. Are they willing to give up the medical and technological advantages that have been brought by science and engineering advances over the last 50 years by investments of the U.S. federal government? Are they willing to give that up in exchange for, I'm not sure what you would be exchanging it for, but for some political goals,
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they'd say, less taxpayers' money spent that way, but and we're right at the end of the time, but I mean, do you guys for now at least have the money that you need to continue the work you're doing?
Right now we do for the next
Okay.
year only, if you want to know what the real timeline is. And we are waiting to hear about applications that we've submitted that would continue the work in the future. And if we do well in the process and there's enough money in the federal budget, then we'll keep going. If not, we'll keep trying. That's the nature of the game.
And that's in for the Center for Mind and Brain that you're talking about in particular. And Srini, anything you want to add to that? As I say, we're very near the end.
Yeah, I think Ron just summed it up fully, but we are in the process of applying for fresh grants, and we're waiting to hear from different foundations and from the National Institutes of Health. So that's a process we keep doing.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both for talking with us today on Davisville about lighting, the research, and the amber lighting. And I think I'm going to go buy some amber light bulbs and put them around the house. So we've been talking with Srinivasan Meyyappan and Professor Ron Mangan, both of UC Davis. They have several credentials. You can look it up. I also encourage you to look at Greg Watry's article titled The Color Lab Uncovers the Soothing Effect of Lights. So Ron and Srini, thank you both for talking with us today.
Thank you,
Thank you.
Bill.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
This is Davisville, KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California. I'm Bill Buchanan. Thank you for listening.